Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get infographics, comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments. And here's Brett.
I've said since the very beginning of my project that school makes good on its promise to prepare young people to be good citizens, right? Like, don't trust yourself, don't trust each other, seek out authorities. So what does citizenship look like in 10 years if schools have become these even more fear-filled and restrictive environments? And I don't know if kids are talking to you about some of the anxieties or the frustrations of what they're encountering actually being in the building.
Oh, yeah. So I would say that there's good and bad news to come with this. So I'll start with the...
Oh, God, yeah, I would love good news, too. Yeah, yeah, we want
there's good and
eventually.
Bad. The bad news is that kids now are in truly a dystopian environment. It's no exaggeration.
Yeah.
It is absolutely insane.
It's okay not to feel okay.
This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Monday, February 15th. Happy Valentine's Day. I made you this podcast. And it is the one-year anniversary of my first conversation with Jay. His online persona is The Honest Teacher. He has a Facebook group called The Honest Teacher. I'm not on Facebook, so I don't know all the details. But I'm guessing it's got close to 20,000 people in it. And that page is known for a more sophisticated type of pro-education, anti-institutionalized schooling meme. We're going to talk about that today as well. So Jay and I talked in February of 2020. And you know how these days everybody's like, oh, things are really different than they were a year ago, huh? There's going to be a little bit of that in this show. But Jay is closer to the public schooling system than I am. So I asked him to give a report on how all that was going. One of the things that we're always focusing on here is outreach. Lots of people now are quietly starting to ask questions they've never asked before. And even quietlier still, starting to contemplate what other options might be available for their children. So, you know, I'm trying to inspire outreach, but also give people some ammunition for it. I was also aware that this is a subject, an exploration that we have been neglecting since our earlier conversations with people like Corey DeAngelis and Carrie McDonald. And I'll get them back on the show in the near future, too. I encourage you to check out Jay's work. It's all linked in the show notes. Definitely be on the Facebook page if you're on Facebook. Jay also has a Patreon. I support him on Patreon, and I think you should, too. By the way, that reminds me. We've had a great run on Patreon recently, and I really appreciate all the new people who've come in, and we're growing this locals community as well. So you can join that locals community. If you just want updates, if you just want to see what's new, you can go to schoolsucksproject.locals.com. It's also a way that you can support us and very easily get access to all the bonus content we've created pretty much since we launched Patreon, like 5 years ago. I put playlists of all our popular serial bonus shows, including The Discomfort Zone, Picture of the Month Club, In Pursuit of Utopia, and I'm working on a highlight reel of the University Weekly Discussion Groups. Man, those are so good. I love them so much. We did one yesterday. I didn't even record it because I was away from my computer, but I was so pleased with the discussion that we had and the new personalities that are mixing in there. Go to ssbuniversity.com. Just spell that university / ideas into action. Enroll in that with the coupon code MySpace, and I will add you to this university group because that is the future. All right. Again, huge thanks to Jay. It was great to have another conversation with him. He'll be back sooner than later. We won't wait another year. But in all three, this is his third time on the show because I split the first one into two parts. His insights and contributions have just been really, really appreciated, and I'm glad he's out there doing what he does. All right, everybody, that's it. Thank you so much for listening. If you've been following us since the beginning, you are about to hear a school bell for the 701st time.
I'm not trying to say my style is better than yours, I'm just on some other shit. I'm all about the beats and the lyrics, so when you hear it, you can feel it. The vibe is energized by the presence of my spirit.
No interference, we persevere. The purpose is clear, we're here to leave your ear hurt and severe. You're lurking in fear, cause we take it back like Robin Loxley, rocking from countryside to spots where hard rocks
I be. I often wonder if these MCs even know how it feels to dedicate their whole life to this mic of steel. It's not about the bill, that's not keeping it real. A lot of tight rappers out here ain't got no deal.
We appeal to the brothers with flow finesse, cause it's the 100-watt bloodshot game of death. Cause we're protected by the covenants of words and beats. Rewind and feel the heat, recline and take a seat.
So, I was saying, before we get started, I'm a little out of sorts. I just kind of scrambled into a hotel about an hour before we started. I'm in, I don't even know what town I'm in. How about that? Lewisburg, West Virginia. You know, preparing for this conversation, and it's been almost a year. Like, it's a week short of a year since the last time we talked. And you, like, recently before our first conversation, you had just left working in the public school environment. You had gone on to private tutoring. And then within, like, I don't know, 3 weeks of me releasing that conversation, man, a lot changed. I have a feeling I'm going to be doing, like, a lot of these where were we a year ago interviews over the next month or so. I actually have a couple other ones planned. Let's start with just updating the Honest Teacher enterprise. What have you been? I see you've done some great interviews over the past year. You had Carrie McDonald on your show. You had Corey DeAngelis. Those are two of my favorites. But what else is new with you, Jay?
Thank you. Yeah. In terms of interviews and stuff like that and whatnot, that was mainly it. You know, I just did a couple of them here and there with Carrie and Corey, and I enjoyed doing it, but I think I definitely spend a lot more time making memes. So that's a lot of what I do, obviously, at this point is just putting out there, you know, thoughts about the schooling system, the schooling paradigm, and getting conversations going. It seems to be a bit more effective, especially as I'm sure you've seen or at least have heard, you know, all the different censorship that's going out there. I think videos are tend to get a bit more throttled still than memes. So I found that investing my time in doing that kind of content with more memeing and stuff like that seems to at least get more circulation, fortunately.
And then there's the question, what do we do with that circulation, right? So I want to hear about your philosophy of memeing. And I certainly have lots of respect for people who rely on memes. I put this question to another guest, actually Isaac Morehouse from Praxis and Crash, maybe like 6 months ago. And I said, are memes kind of like a form of newspeak from 1984 in that it's closing the conversation in too much? Like, you have to oversimplify. But is that what is necessary today to, like, actually convey what could be or what could be expanded into a meaningful message?
Sure. I mean, for me, I've always have found memes to just be a great starting point. It's a way to get people's attention where, you know, they may not necessarily have time to open a book, or that might be too daunting with other things they have going on. But if they're just scrolling and they happen to see an image or something catchy, you know, some words or a sentence that's catchy, people will engage with that, and they'll at least, you know, even if they don't read it right away, they might share it to go back to later. And I've found over the years, and I've, you know, I've used this in many, of course, other fields that I do work in and work for promoting a freer future. I definitely have used memes to educate people and inspire and start discourse. And I would say that in a lot of the memes I do make, I would say there's probably a bit more wordiness to them in some of them.
Sure. Yeah, you take it a step. You do take it a step beyond, because you post a lot in the School Sucks group, which I actually just froze. And then I was like, man, now Jay posted in there all the time, and now no one can post, no one can like anything. And I know that was a good outlet for your stuff, even though you have your own very successful Facebook page. So I had been meaning to get you back for a while, but I was like, no, now's the time, because I just locked all these people out of posting in the School Sucks Facebook page. So your presence on Facebook is still going strong, right?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't had too much trouble overall, at least with the Honest Teacher page. That doesn't really seem to at least fall into any type of censorship rules or weird things like that. I did lose one account at one point in the October censorship waves, but I, you know, was very prepared for that, because I stay way ahead of what's going on with the censorship and know what's going to happen typically before it does take place, so I can kind of stay ahead of the curve. But you know, I knew eventually I was going to go down with Facebook's new rules and going back, you know, way further in time. So I, you know, fortunately still kept everything up and have still been getting pretty good outreach overall with that page, even though it's something that I don't devote a crazy amount of time to. But the, you know, what I do does appear to have an impact with people in terms of getting them to have good conversations and, you know, drive at different issues with compulsory schooling. I mean, even just today, you know, addressing a teacher in the threads. And that's what I get a lot of is, you know, I get teachers at school saying that's not true, or it's not like that, or I'm not like that. And then I have to, you know, break down what it is they do in specific terms of actions and actors. And, you know, the ones that keep coming back, there's the teachers that keep coming back, I think are there because they know it's wrong. Like they get it. They're starting to be like, it kind of itches at them.
Yeah.
And so they keep coming back. The ones that don't, like, just, you know, dismiss it. But the teachers I keep, you know, seeing come back time and again, you know, that it's definitely having an effect on them. And of course, I've also had teachers come to me and say, oh, wow, you know, I really didn't think about it this way, and, you know, asked for help or thought about how to get out of that system. So definitely memes are definitely a great way to get people to think outside the compulsory schooling paradigm and to have discourses that challenge a lot of ideas that, you know, they would never get challenged otherwise, you know, because they're completely within their bubble of being at school. And of course, being able to shut down any discourse that they don't like in their working environment. So,
yeah. So it is a pattern interruption that can exist in its entirety in one frame of a phone scroll or a computer screen, which makes it very useful. And that is encouraging to hear that it's some of the stuff you're doing is actually generating dialogue. By the way, what did you get in trouble for on Facebook, if I may ask? Because I bet my audience is curious as they wait to get in trouble if they haven't yet.
Right. I don't know. I really don't know because the band that I received was one of those total bands where, you know, there was no like lead up to it. There was not like, oh, you got a 7 and 30. It was account suspension. And that's when Facebook did their first attack on those whose, I guess you could say, behaviors. That is, they have a machine learning algorithm that looks at behaviors for how people interact with their profiles and with other pages. And they were eliminating anyone who they thought had too much of an influence potentially on ideology leading up to the election. So that was a big part of it, was that those at Facebook were basically trying to eliminate people who they thought were influencers. And, you know, I kind of like studied it, read their white paper, and, you know, looked at how people got banned and asked a lot of questions, and kind of came down to the idea that those who were very actively posting on pages and places where their, I guess you could say, IP address wasn't located in terms of their state or location, Facebook looked at that as, you know, suspicious or aberrant behavior. And that's how they labeled it superficially. They tried to say, oh, that, you know, this must be some like fake accounts or troll, you know, accounts. But
yeah,
in reality, what they were doing is they were taking down people who might be commenting on other pages outside the region. You know, for example, like dogpiling. If you ever see, you know, maybe there's a police post and they're talking about some drug bust or something, and you'd see a bunch of people come in and say how bad the police are for doing that. Like, that's an example of the kind of behavior they're going after. They're going after people who were trying to change discourse and get other people into ideas they might not otherwise see outside of their geography.
Yeah, I mean, that's the world that I've been a part of for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We're a nuisance.
Yeah.
Considering that, you know, Facebook has been a big hub for you, there's lots of people following your page or liking your page there and interacting with what you post. Last time you were here, we talked about the future of the Honest Teacher project. Are you thinking about anything like, how does this survive beyond Facebook if it needs to?
Yeah, I mean, personally, if Facebook, you know, took it away, I'd be like, whatever, it's no big deal. I don't care. The memes will live on. But the, you know, backups I have, which I do have, are, you know, in other places like minds.com. I have a Honest Teacher there. I have an Honest Teacher on MeWe. I personally don't think MeWe will last in terms of, you know, possible censorship issues. But for now, at least, it's definitely a possible backup. So I have things going on in those places, and I have a little, you know, YouTube, whatever. I don't think there's crazy amount of anything on there, but I do have the ability to, in the event that I did get a removal on Facebook, to continue, you know, posting the key things I was posting before to some places where I'm sure, as you've seen, now that lots of people have been removed from Facebook, have gotten way more traction. So, you know, in the net end, it'll be all good.
And can you just bring my audience up to speed? Like, if you go back a year,
sure,
you were moving away from working in and around public schooling, and you had moved into private tutoring. So can you just talk about where you were then and how everything changed for you about less than a month after we talked in March?
Absolutely. Yeah. In terms of tutoring, things like that, yeah, I'd left the compulsory schooling paradigm, teaching and you know, various different subjects for both middle school and high school in the past. And I'd already created my tutoring company back then and still done tutoring while teaching. But then I switched to just doing private tutoring, among other things that I do. And since that time, you know, with all the shutdowns and craziness, you kind of wonder like, oh, is it going to be different or bad, or how does that affect everything? I'd say by and large, I ended up having more, tutoring hours because with everything being shut down at the beginning, there was lots of need for help for students just trying to figure out what to do with all of the technology they were using. And that was quite interesting because for many schools around the country, they went off like ad hoc, they just winged it. Especially in the early shutdowns, because they, you know, didn't really have the infrastructure. So just like, okay, well, we're going to shut down and then we'll try to, you know, use Microsoft Teams and other things like Canvas and stuff to get students to do online classes. And in the beginning, I would say it was more disorganized because all the different teachers are trying to figure out what they're going to do about it and, you know, where they're going to post assignments and homework. And it's very frustrating for a lot of kids, for sure. Yeah. Just because, you know, in the beginning, everything's, you know, in all different places and you're just trying to hunt down what the heck they're doing. And a lot of teachers, you know, don't know the technology well. And then once things went to summer, then many schools started to kind of figure out a more solid plan of what they were going to do in terms of, you know, how they're going to provide instruction online. And then it was a bit more organized, but I would say from an ethical standpoint too, a lot of kids' detriment, because before they were much more relaxed on kids in terms of parenting stuff.
Yeah, I've heard the same stories. I talked to my niece a lot about this, and she definitely described what happened at the end of the 2019-2020 school year, so going into the summer, as being really disorganized. But you know, the silver lining that I saw at the time was that kids are getting a whole bunch of their lives and, you know, their personal time back. And people were telling me, other people that I talked to who are in school were saying this, yeah, it's like a 3 hour a day commitment. And I was like, this is great news. But, you know, like we've seen with work from home, it's kind of like now these two environments that were really distinct, even though, gosh, you know, for a long time, school had tried and has in many ways invaded the home through, you know, excess amounts of homework and converting parents into policemen for the school. But now the line is like completely blurred between what is school time and what is free time, as much as that exists.
Right. And it's definitely, as you noted at the beginning, there was a bit more benefit than detriment, because with all the disorganization, teachers figuring out stuff, there was way more forgiveness. Eventually teachers were like, oh, okay, turn things in at the end of the day. So, you know, kids could actually sleep in and kind of, you know, not have to show up for everything and not have to show up for every period, but like watch videos later. So it made it a lot better. And I think that was a good thing, because it did awaken for many parents the idea of, oh, you know, they're wasting their time with all this other stuff. There's, you know, there's a better way to do this that doesn't, you know, soak up much of their day. So it definitely, I think, encouraged a lot of parents to investigate homeschooling, unschooling, things like that, which was great. But then come the next, you could say school year, then they got more serious. And instead of it being like, oh, we'll put a video up and you can watch it at your convenience, they started to say, you know, you need to check in every period and you know, need to show you're there if you're doing the specialized remote learning. And that became a real nuisance, because then it's like, you know, you have to sit there for every single class, even if it's like the dumbest, you know, stuff going on or it's meaningless to you, you know, then you still have to like keep your, you know, camera on or whatever, depending on the class. And that got a bit more annoying. I would say for students to have to then be digitally monitored on top of everything. So that, from what I saw, it did incentivize some students to go back into school. Although I did see, from my experience, a lot of students not wanting to do it in the sense that they got used to the home life and being able to relax their computer.
Okay, so I've talked to teachers too, and one teacher friend of mine is like, yeah, the kids won't turn their cameras on. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, like, just from your experience interacting with students, do you know of like what kind of consequences they try to impose for people who have just become more and more disengaged?
Well, I've seen just mostly like at this point, marking them absent, possibly. That's one thing. You know, if you don't have it, then they'll say, oh, you are absent. I have seen one interesting specific situation that was relayed to me, was where it was a young girl who she was having some type of issue with her computer itself. And then the teacher was berating her, but the teacher didn't know that the girl's mom was right there. So the teacher thought, like, you know, she was being slick and, you know, yelling at her, even though it was a genuine computer issue, it wasn't her fault. And the mom like saw that. And it was like a, you know, a pill moment for her. Like, oh my gosh, like this is how they treat my kids when I'm not looking. I would say that was, that's been a very big thing. I would say for any parent that's at least semi-engaged, just, you know, checking out what's going on. A lot of them are starting to see, you know, how things are being run through the school day, what the curriculum is and how their kids are being treated. And I would say more often than not, they're getting a bit disheartened. So,
oh yeah. Disheartened is a word, right? there's lots of words. So the kind of work that you're doing, right, it involves students and parents and maybe some like liaison work with actual schools and teachers, correct?
Definitely.
So when I was doing this, and I mean, I was doing this in a totally different world, you know, like 15 years ago I started maybe. Back then, I had parents who needed almost emotional support about, and this, you know, if their kids had special ed or things they were actually dealing with in the school environment or frustrating you know, experiences not being able to get through to teachers, things like that. Now that they're seeing these things, right? So this, again, is a possible silver lining as these things come into the home. And we haven't even gotten to the part where these kids are going back into these buildings in entirely more watchful and restrictive environments. But just as far as, like, parents seeing this stuff come into the home, have you had any interactions with parents, like the one you just described? Is that becoming a more common theme, like a kind of wake up to what's actually going on there? Because what I think has been nice, especially for people who have to shell out, you know, so much in property tax to pay for the system, they want to tell themselves a story about, you know, when my kid goes off there, they're learning and they're playing volleyball and having friends and whatever. But that story is getting harder and harder to tell. And I don't know if you see that becoming a pattern through the work you do.
Yeah, I would say definitely from stories I've heard from others, I haven't I guess you could say had too much personal experience with that. You could say, like, in terms of like the parents like shifting greatly. I mean, some of the parents would obviously, based on what, you know, we would talk about, would see, oh, okay, they're really disorganized, or okay, this is not comfortable. But I would say from other stories that people have relayed to me and their kids and their different respective schools, I have seen that situation come up with parents really starting to see firsthand just how torturous the school day is. But again, the problem there for some parents is they're just so happy to have a babysitter that, you know, that always outweighs it, unfortunately, in some cases. So
what do you know about what's actually happening in the schools for the kids who come back? And I understand they're doing all these like rotating schedules. Not everybody's there all at once. But I've said since the very beginning of my project that school makes good on its promise to prepare young people to be good citizens. Right. Like, don't trust yourself. Don't trust each other. Seek out authorities. So one of the things that's really kind of distressing is that what does citizenship look like in 10 years if schools have become these even more like fear-filled and restrictive environments? And I don't know if kids are talking to you about some of the anxieties or the frustrations of what they're encountering actually being in the building.
Oh, yeah. So definitely I would say that there's good and bad news to come with this. So I'll start with the
I would love good news too.
There's good and bad. The bad news is that the kids now are in truly a dystopian environment. It's no exaggeration. Yeah. It is absolutely insane. And it's absolutely insane because what they're doing is completely socially isolating kids through masking and spacing, having lunches where, you know, the kids are so far apart and broken up that they can't even talk to meaningfully anybody. And it's making, you know, lots of these kids just feel so miserable. You know, they are just absolutely dreading the school day because of how restrictive it is. And what makes it extra painful and anxiety building is that in many of these schools, the teachers themselves are fearful. A lot of teachers, way more than the kids, of course. Lots of teachers are super fearful about this, and they're very punitive when it comes to the mask wearing. And what this means is that now kids are feeling anxiety about their mask coming off because if it slips down to this, so that they get in trouble, they can get sent to the principal's office, they can, you know, get detentions even. So what's happening is now kids are worried about whether or not like they have to itch their nose or whether their, you know, face mask slips down. And like, for example, one student I work with said that there's even a kid who's next to him who's using the mask that the school gave him, because the school like gave out 5 masks at the beginning of the year for students to reuse, but it doesn't fit. Like, so it always falls down. So he's like constantly having to pull it back up. So it's one of these things where it's the kids are under an enormous amount of pressure because they're literally, I mean, if you think about it, it's like balancing an egg on your head kind of thing and being worried constantly, if it's going to tip. It's that level of anxiety for some of these kids because they're worried about being yelled at if they, take their mask to have a sip of water or whatever, or it just slips, or they have an itch, or if they yawn. And like my one student who does have a good fitting mask, if you yawn, okay, it comes down off your nose and they get yelled at. So they have now there's the idea if you're just distracted, this, that, you might get yelled at or something. But now it's like you have a physical thing on you that is a point of observation for punishment constantly lingering on you. So it's really crazy. And one student told me that he'll even go to the bathroom just so that he can breathe for 3 minutes without his mask on. And it really is torturous. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of parents don't get that and how just torturous it is for kids to have that anxiety about being worried about getting in trouble for something that, can readily just come off either on its own or just, of course, just by living, by yawning or whatever, you have a scratch, something like that. So it's really rough for these kids in school where they have to abide by all these extremely alienating and terrible, distancing and masking rules. And the good news out of that is that I would say by and large, most of the young people, from what I've seen and what they tell me, say that the kids think it's stupid. So that's good. Like, there's your first, silver lining, is that a lot of these kids are observant and see like, wow, this is really dumb. Like, we're in here together all day and you're not going to be able to do this forever. And kids are always like touching their masks and touching their stuff. They know it's stupid. They know that, you can't put off the inevitable. And they look at their teachers, like, for example, this one music teacher, she's like behind plexiglass. And then like, she says that like, basically kids can't come like closer than 10 feet to her. And she stays all the way to the back of the classroom. All the kids are super far away. Like that kind of level of like almost OCD level behavior. Like the kids just look at it and they're just like, wow, these people are dumb. What are you doing teaching here if you're that scared, kind of thing. So the good news is that I would say, fortunately, by and large, a lot of young people do recognize the absurdity of it all in the first place and do resent how they're treated because of the masking rules. So
sure. It was obvious that all of these things would, become another vector for punishment.
Right.
Where, we all remember being in school and like, why is this rule that we can't do this on the playground? And because one time somebody fell off the playground, and that's kind of like not super impactful. But now I'm sure when you talk about this kind of panic that teachers are passing on to kids like that, it's like, because somebody could die. Mm-hmm. And that seems so that is encouraging that kids are pushing back a little bit, because that seems so final, a kind of justification for the restrictions and the increased punishments that they're also experiencing, that they're not, from what you're saying anyway, it doesn't seem like they're being completely broken. Because I feel like we could get accused of being like hyperbolic for saying this is a form of torture, but it is like a sustained form of physical discomfort, which does not do well for like the emotional state of developing minds. And I also wonder if any kids have confided in you about that impact, because it goes beyond masks, right? It's there's so many more aspects to this in the school environment.
Sure. No, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't shy away from using the word torture. I do think it's torturous, especially considering that for many of these kids, they're having to wear the same mask all day and it gets really disgusting and sweaty. Obviously collecting humidity from breathing out into it, and then you put it on your chin when you're eating lunch, or it goes in the bathroom. I mean, it is absolutely gross, and I'm very certain that there will be bacterial pneumonias that come from that over time and this or that, just because they touch something and then of course get an itch in the mask, and then one thing leads to another. And I would say the most torturous part, of course, even beyond that, is just the ever-present anxiety of being worried if you're going to get punished because it comes off, and it's not even, an intentional act of it coming off. But the teachers, of course, will treat it with that level of fear and that level of severity in many cases. From what I hear, more often than not, more teachers are anxious about it because, as most of the teachers are authoritarians who themselves rely on authoritarianism, for how they think.
And are under the thumb of it, too.
Right.
That was a huge part of being a teacher. I just talked about this on a recent show with this young woman, Casey, who works at a self-directed learning center down in Texas. Mm-hmm. Casey Youngins is her name. I don't know if you've crossed paths with her yet. But, you know, we were both sharing experiences about teaching, and it's like, okay, let's make sure, and this is early in our careers or when starting a new job, let's make sure we're doing all the right things for everybody except the students and ourselves. Right. So who does that leave? The people above us. So I'm sure the kind of bureaucratic pressure that's coming down on these people as well, while they're already like totally acclimated to an environment where that kind of treatment of young people is just totally acceptable, right? Because it existed in all these areas before this happened. So it's natural that they would, in many ways, unthinkingly just extend all that into this.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I've seen this personally and in watching other videos from different school districts outside my state where they, you know, they have their protocols for what they do in terms of, you know, they're staying safe, you could say, or staying insane, more like it. You know, it's very regimented, authoritarian, and extraordinarily painful because of how exacting it is and how much stress you feel, just being both uncomfortable and worried that expressing your discomfort or trying to accommodate your discomfort is going to lead to being punished. It's terrible. But I would say, again, the kids definitely are resenting it from what I've seen and what I've heard.
Okay, so I don't want to talk about teachers in a completely monolithic way either, because I'm sure there are teachers who, considering all of these things that they've had to do since last March, there's got to be a group of teachers. I mean, I know there is, because I've talked to some of these people who are like, you know, at this point, I've had enough. And I don't know if you've encountered anyone like that or had any of those conversations.
No, I have not seen of or heard of any teachers who have necessarily had enough in the way that you're speaking. I would say, by and large, most of the people who I've seen or interacted with who themselves are teachers have, bought hook, line, and sinker into it. If they're actively teaching in a compulsory schooling environment. And even sadly, I think this is also horrible, but I've seen that happen for many unschooling centers or self-directed learning co-ops where they have enforced some of those rules in very bizarre ways. So
how have you found, just from your attentiveness to all this, that this has opened up the conversation to alternatives, whether we're talking about students or parents, or I guess in some cases teachers, even though they'd probably be like last on the list, unless they are parents and they're dealing with this with their own kids?
I think so. I think I've seen some people start to recognize, I'm not saying this is a deep change, but I have seen people start to be like, oh wow, you know, this really is inconsiderate of young people, and you know, just how, and just kind of how ridiculous it is. And I have seen some people start to like question things going forward on that. You know, just the idea that they see the blanket mask policy, they see how ridiculous it is to think that, you know, little kids are gonna, you know, maintain hygiene throughout 7 or 8 hours straight, not likely happening. You know what I mean? And then what, you're just going to put them in little circles and, you know, separate them. So some parents have seen that this, you know, doesn't really make much sense, you know, and I have seen some parents reach out and say, okay, from their vantage, they have awakened to the idea that maybe there's a better way to do things.
Yeah. So. Do you find, though, that they still wind up, because this is like a really common theme. And when I try to do research on like the impact on students of this whole situation, whether it's K through 12 or it's college, everything is framed in terms of the virus did this and the virus, the same thing we see in the news, right? The virus caused the shutdowns, the virus caused economic downturn. So I would imagine that that's a very easy kind of framing to take place in the school environment too. We have to do this. And then that kind of steers around people actually questioning policies or restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. That has been 100% from what I've seen and personal experience, the case that those in the public school system obfuscate reality by not labeling the right actors and actions and giving them due credit for who's actually enforcing things. They kind of anthropomorphize coronavirus and say like, oh, it's Corona that's doing this. Like, no, there's human beings who are shutting down the economy or saying you do this, we'll, you know, fine you or arrest you or something. So I definitely bring that up with, you know, some of the young people I see and work with, where in the past they may have even framed it that way themselves. And I'm like, oh, is that how they frame it in school? And they're like, yeah. And then I'm like, okay, well, let's think who's actually doing this, you know, then have those conversations. But yeah, I mean, it is a very common trope in schools to basically abstract from both, you know, government and teachers themselves in the school system, the responsible persons, and to lay it on some type of idea or ideal instead of actually saying, okay, who is actually taking the actions to do what to what, or, you know, what to who. So
yeah,
absolutely.
No, I just ask because, like, I'd look at a study and it would be like, this is 2,000 college students. This one's 30,000, mm-hmm. you know, college undergraduate students. In the first study, it's like 91% experience increasing stress and anxiety, disappointment and sadness. But then the reasons, if they're asked to, you know, assign a causal relationship to that, it has to do with policy. Mm-hmm. But it's framed as like the virus gave them more stress and anxiety. Yeah. Same with the study that was much larger. So that's just like par for the course in the public conversation about this, which is also disappointing.
Right. And one, I would say, key thing too that has been changing minds, funnily enough, and this happened to one of my students, is actually getting coronavirus. So my one student, he was visiting his dad in California, and his family there tested positive. They got sick. You know, nothing crazy for all of them. I mean, you know, one person had a little bit, you know, lacking taste for, you know, a few days, but basically all of them had symptoms that resolved within about 3 days. And of course, because that happened, couldn't fly, couldn't leave for 2 weeks. You know, can, you know, get on a plane to get home. So he was out of school, you know, in a nice way, for a couple weeks because of that. And when he came back, you know, we talked about it, and we talked about, you know, reflecting on like the fears of it versus his experience. And he's like, yeah, you know, it wasn't actually that bad. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, and that's actually pretty much the case for most people, unless, you know, you're very elderly or you have some serious underlying condition. But I'm like, by and large, most people are fine. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, and you know what? Now it's ridiculous. He's like, why do I have to wear a mask? I already got over it. He's like, what, you know what I mean? He's like, why do I, have to, you know, wear a mask now? I'm like, exactly. It's like, why are you having to, you know, continue to live in misery if you've already gotten it and gotten over it and should have some, at least, immunity to it? You know, given that obviously his body has already had an immune reaction and he did overcome it. So, you know, it that experience, I think itself kind of helps getting it. You know, that is because young people suddenly feel more empathy, because now they're like, oh, okay, it's not scary. I'm, you know, not going to die. And they don't when themselves want to be looked at as like evil or bad or, you know what I mean? Or something like dangerous, right? If you had like, oh, you have corona or something like that, you know, they don't want to be looked at as weird or odd. So it normalizes it, which is, you know, oddly enough, nice, because it gets rid of some of that anxiety, right? They're, you know, no longer living in that fear about it because of the abstractions that they hear from their teachers and in the news that they show, you know, CNN 10, and I'm sure they're scaring them to death on CNN 10. So
you talked a little bit about your work changing. And as a private service provider, I remember, like I said earlier in the conversation, you do have to wear many hats, you know, in some cases, because there is that close connection or you're working with somebody one-on-one, you do take on more of a therapeutic role. Like, people will confide in you about more things than, say, if you were a teacher mm-hmm. and you were one of like 20 people, they were, you know, juggling at a time. So that was always my experience with that. That was like the best work with young people that I ever did, right? Was in that setting. So what would you say, you know, over the last almost year now, has been the biggest cost and the biggest benefit, or a big cost and a big benefit to the kind of work that you do?
Well, with government corona stuff, I would say the benefit would be like it opens up some interesting conversations to have about the nature of the government and science as relates to viruses and things like that. Overall, I mean, that definitely was interesting. And business-wise, of course, it actually helped in some ways, just some students needing some more help. Of course, I would say the hard part, at least this is my experience, might be extrapolable, but I would say fewer people wanted to do in-person tutoring in terms of, you know, new clients or something like that. I think definitely more people were scared of, you know, getting help on an in-person level, but then it changed a bit to, you know, some more people asking for remote help and things like that. Yeah, overall, I'd say nothing has materially changed for me in that regard, you know, in terms of my lifestyle and in terms of meeting students. And I didn't have too much, you know, problems or fears as relates to the students I was already seeing. The families, at least, that I was seeing, you know, weren't irrationally afraid to the point of, you know, being scared if I, you know, came over, something like that.
So back to the very beginning of that part, mm-hmm. One of the benefits, you said there was more conversation about the whole nature of the system and, you know, questioning, having the audacity to question the science. Mm-hmm. Do you find that kids are generally receptive to that kind of inquiry if you lead them in it?
For me, I generally don't have any problems with it, just because it's easy for me to frame it in a way that's very conversational, because I don't try to frame things to load the question or like change your mind.
I don't have a dog in this fight.
Right. A lot of it is framing it from like, what do they think about it and why, and asking, you know, probing questions about how they came to believe what they believe. And in that process, of course, you know, that's where like the answers come out, like, I'm not exactly sure, you know, or I got to look into that, kind of, you know, come out in the process. And so, obviously with all the shutdown stuff, with how teachers are acting and reacting, it definitely opened up a lot of great conversations, and including even, you know, to go further than the virus stuff, the election conversations about what was going on there, and what teachers were doing. Because, you know, I get the usual stories of some teacher saying, oh, yeah, we're not supposed to talk about politics. And then, of course, they slip in their two cents. So it's always fun to have those conversations about what teachers are saying and, you know, what are the common tropes of slipped in commentary about politics.
Yeah, there's kind of this like the appeal that conspiracy theories have for a lot of people, which is like there's some kind of emotional payoff in putting a puzzle together. So like maybe something piques some of our interest, like I could give examples. I don't want to get you in trouble, even though you're completely anonymous. So I won't name a conspiracy that kind of set me off and running in a certain direction. But it can become a curiosity that spreads into other things. So now, again, back to silver linings with these kids. And I'm wondering if there are any like revelatory moments that you've had with them that are particularly memorable. But they've never been given more of a chance to question things, right? Because I don't think things have ever been so literally in their face,
right,
as they are right now with this. So it seems like that an even mildly precocious young person is going to be questioning things that they might have just been able to like autopilot or put their head down through in the past.
Right. Absolutely. There's been so much disruptive activity going on this past year that it's caused a lot of young people to think about big picture questions and question why the specific actions are being done to them in school and whether or not they're good or make sense. So I do think that there will be some very long-term ramifications of how young people were treated going forward, both in good and bad ways. Of course, the bad being, you know, how they were hurt by it. But I think that there actually will probably be a lot of young people who grow up thinking we should not do that again. You know, we didn't let that happen again. Yeah.
Yeah. Even before this situation, this was like an observation as a student and an observation as a teacher, and working in some really like high stress environments with kids who had a lot of like emotional and behavioral difficulties. Mm-hmm. There's punishments for conformity and there's punishments for rebellion. And I think those who rebel, maybe it depends on to what extent they rebel, but maybe in the long run, they often stand a better chance because they've at least practiced that like pushing back and thinking for themselves versus just, you know, totally breaking and conforming and never questioning anything.
Right.
So, yeah, I think people here will go both ways. Like this will have, you know, in the school makes good citizens idea, it will really, really push some people into like fearful and helpless places. Mm-hmm. But it will do, and maybe that's a minority, but maybe that's okay. It will do the other thing as well. It will push people into, you know, higher levels of curiosity than what they would have had otherwise.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely see that happening, especially across young people who are a bit more intellectually mature. I think maybe in the middle school to high school arena, a bit more so, young people recognizing the ridiculousness. You know, obviously elementary, it's a little bit more, you know, kind of like, oh, just what is this? It's all new. And they might accept things a little bit more just because the adult said so. But definitely in middle and high school, there's a lot more observation of, oh, okay, this, you know, this doesn't make any sense. And, you know, in terms of practicality and daily activities of, you know, how they're being treated. So I do foresee some good things coming out of that. And I think in some ways it's unique because, you know, to have that empathetic experience, you know, a lot of the adults today didn't have something like this in the past. They don't have something to relate to think, even, oh, this is terrible. So, you know, unfortunately, a lot of adults have limited empathy. And of course, as you know, schooling is a part of that equation, reducing empathy. And I think that many adults, you know, just didn't have the capacity, at least right now, to really think about how this is going to impact kids. But I think that many kids going forward are going to be able to think, as they get older, how this will impact future kids.
Yeah. And there's a same boat benefit to this that has never really existed before. And we talked about that, like with school coming into the homes and parents becoming more observational because it's like school's right there.
Right.
There's that. But, you know, over the last 11 months, everybody's kind of gone through similar things. Right. So I think there's more of a possibility for parents, you know, as they have experienced their own anxieties and inconveniences around this, like maybe there's more of a point of connection than there was before.
Right.
Where, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, these are the things that are being imposed on all of us everywhere. My message hasn't changed that much. I mean, honestly, I feel like I've kind of steered away from, you know, digging deep into like what the psychological impact has been, because I knew what it was before this. I knew how bad it was. Like all the stuff I've said for the last decade, you know, now it's worse. And that's sad to think about.
Right.
It's really maybe one of the reasons why I've been kind of avoidant with this topic. And the signal that we've tried to send out over the last year has been more about, you know, various types of self-defense, but also alternatives. And also, well, as more people look for educational alternatives, here's what real education looks like. So that's like, those are the bases that I've tried to cover. But as I was preparing for this conversation with you, I was like, boy, I've really steered around like digging into a real examination of the new ways that this environment really sucks for young people.
Right.
And just to kind of like, as we work our way out here on maybe a positive note, I know towards the end of last year, you talked to both Carrie McDonald and Corey DeAngelis. I talked to them last year too. I haven't talked to Carrie since the beginning of all of this, where we were just basically trying to figure out what was going to happen. And it was, you know, largely about what we thought policy would be like and what we thought embrace of alternatives would look like over the rest of 2020. Corey and I talk more about policy, both the conversations that we had. But did they share any, because you talked to them, I think, in the fall, like the beginning of this current school year.
Right.
Was there any memorable optimism that they shared with you about this situation?
Yeah, but in both of their research and their work, they were seeing, you know, the patterns that I had seen as well, is that more families were opting out. They were starting to really actually not just, you know, temporarily, but fully move out of this compulsory schooling paradigm and starting to homeschool. And in many states, they saw, you know, upticks or increases of the number of families, you know, starting to go into homeschooling or unschooling in, you know, I would say 2-10% arena, you know, and that was earlier this year, of course. And I think since that time, there's been increases in that as well. So, you know, they were very hopeful about that, that, you know, basically they said that looks like, you know, 5 million kids might be coming out into the homeschool arena, you know, by the end of 2020. So I'm not sure what all materialized or who decided to actually continue or to stay, but it was heading in that direction of possibly being that big if the trend continued.
Yeah, and that's going to be the next battle. And that's a good place to actually have the battle, right? Which means like a battle needs to be had there. Like, what's the regulatory trap around that as more and more people want to do it? It's kind of like what the, you know, what the charter school or the voucher argument was. It's like as this becomes a more appealing option to people, especially people in impoverished areas where the schools are not as, finger quotes, good as they are in higher income areas, people embracing these alternatives means that we need more eyes on this. We need more regulation. We need the teachers' unions involved, that these people have to come under that umbrella if they want to work in these places. So I think, yeah, we're going to see as homeschooling, if it expands over the next couple of years to 5 million people in the country, we're going to see more and more of that kind of conversation happen. But I think that that's an encouraging thing, that that's now a fight that's actually going to be had on a larger scale. And Corey, that was what Corey and I first touched base about, was when the Harvard professor said that homeschooling should be made illegal.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, the positive part of that was like, okay, now at least there's a conversation about the threat this is to the institution.
Right.
So things are moving in the right direction, even if there's a fight ahead. So I think that's all encouraging.
And that was a great example of someone who had a lot of schooling, but was still very dumb. Like, it, really, I mean, because when you saw her arguments for it, you know, when they had the debate lined out, it was terrible. I mean, she really did not think through anything of what she was writing. She was using basically, you know, not large enough sample sizes, not randomized enough, mostly like almost borderline like anecdotal stories to back up what she was saying. And then, like, you know, Corey's like, here's all the hard data of, like, you know, basically the most major studies that have been done in all these different areas. You know, if you want to talk about homeschooling and incidents of whatever you want to say, neglect or success or whatever. And I mean, she was just roasted. I mean, it was bad. You know what I mean? It was like, really? This is what you're passing? Like, are you kidding me? Like,
yeah, it's true. It's funny because she wasn't like a professor of education. If I remember correctly, she was a law professor, right? And I remember watching that and reading the article too. And I was like, boy, this really is just a language of fallacies.
Yeah.
That these people get away with speaking.
And even worse, like just the ability to take what is, you know, completely unscientific studies. And I'm saying this in the truest sense of the word, that is studies that were done where it wasn't like a broad-based random sample, and then use, like, you know, a very, you know, bad bias their selection to try to make your argument. You know what I mean? It is something that level that, you know, she was using. It was, you know, really terrible reference material, like abysmally bad.
Oh, yeah. I went through that, and I wasn't trying to be snotty when I was watching it. I think I wound up, Carrie and I wound up doing a follow-up conversation about it, but I didn't even want to comment too much on, you know, all of the logical problems with it. I think we just did like a post-mortem and tried to pull some positivity out of it.
Right.
So I'm off Facebook, but a lot of my audience is still there. Is that still the best way to get involved with you and follow you?
Yeah, I mean, all that I do in terms of involvement or follow is just like, oh, hey, if you like my memes or a video, you can
share them.
But I would say if you're really passionate about and want to talk in a building way, I guess, like not call people names, because that usually doesn't help. There's always people who are coming to the threads of my photos, I should say memes, who are teachers or parents who are, you know, kind of seeking, sometimes challenging, of course, but I think more so seeking what the truth is as relates to like unschooling and homeschooling, what's going on with that. And I'm really proud of the people there, because I mean, again, I have nothing to do with this. These are people doing it on their own, and I'd have to imagine that a good number of them are probably you know, associated with or products of, you know, so much knowledge that you've imparted to them through all your different podcasts and great, you know, people you've interviewed. But they really know their stuff in there, and, you know, come in the threads and educate them. And like, sometimes I'll go down to say something, and I'm like, oh wow, they actually did so elegantly, I don't really have to say anything, I'm good. You know, so it's nice to have support from people sometimes, because I can't devote as much time as I'd like to that page and my work to be able to talk to every person. But it's nice to see other people who are that passionate about unschooling and self-directed education coming in and intelligently informing people who have questions or who have criticisms. So it gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, that's really great to hear. And is there anywhere else where you'd want people from my audience to be following you or interacting with you?
I mean, they can go to Minds, MeWe. I have a YouTube that I post to sparingly, but, you know, there's some old videos there, and, you know, interviews and things like that. And I have, you know, Patreon or whatever, but I barely, you know, use that. So it was more just, you know, for function. I was like, whatever. But to me, you know, the Facebook is definitely where the most amount of engagement takes place. But obviously I still will post content here and there to MeWe and Minds as backups.
Excellent. So we got to talk more often. There's so many different subjects we could explore together. So I'm not going to let another year go by. I will touch base with you in the near future, and we'll do this again on one of many topics.
Yes. No, thank you, Brett. I'd be honored. And there's so many different things we talk about. Absolutely. So
we should do like a round table at some point. We should get a group together.
I would be 100% down for that.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for coming back on the show. And I'll make sure all your stuff is linked in the notes. And we will talk again soon.
All right. My pleasure, Brett.
Don't mean a thing if I don't.